Hi everyone, welcome back to Season 2, Episode 5 of the EFL Magazine Business Podcast. Today's guest is Dave Sperling. Dave is the founder and owner of Dave's ESL Cafe. After teaching around the world and completing his MA in linguistics in 1995, he created Dave's ESL Cafe as a meeting place for ESL, EFL teachers and students from around the world. It's an extra long one today, 2 hours. I really hope you enjoyed it. I had a great time chatting today.
Hey everyone, buckle up for a new episode of the EFL Magazine Business Podcast, the one and only podcast made to help you launch your business or take your existing business to a level of success you could never have imagined. Whether you're a school owner, freelancer, publisher, or other entrepreneur, you're sure to pick up lots of actionable advice when you listen to the EFL Magazine Business Podcast. Remember to visit EFLmagazine.com for great articles and features. Without further ado, here's your host, the founder of EFL Magazine, Philip Pound.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the latest episode of the EFL Magazine Business Podcast. It's my great pleasure to introduce the one and only Dave Sperling. Good morning, good evening, Dave.
Good day.
Good day, yeah.
Hey, hello.
Hello, and you're in LA at the moment.
I am, yeah. I'm in Los Angeles in Southern California, and it is evening time here.
It's evening. And I think, you know, I'm really getting to know LA now through Bosch. If you know the TV series Bosch, well, it's on Amazon Prime.
He's the
original books by Michael Connelly. But, you know, growing up, with the A-Team and all these TV series in the 80s, all these shows were made in LA or just outside LA, but they weren't actually about LA, were they? I mean, they didn't really... They pretended to be somewhere else, but Bosch is about LA. And so tell me about LA.
LA. Well, I'm people that are born and raised in LA, we call Angelinos.
Ah.
So I am an Angelino. My kids are Angelinos, my siblings. I spend a lot of time in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and I love it. But I'm more comfortable in Southern California. It's Los Angeles is a complicated city. It's not something you could just say in a couple of sentences. It's vast. It's incredibly multicultural. And it has a huge amount of course, Latinos. Maybe not quite the majority, but pretty close. Huge ethnic neighborhoods, gigantic Koreatown, big Thai town, Monterey Park, San Gabriel Valley, where you have all the Chinese population and the restaurants and the shopping malls and all of that. Then, of course, you have Hollywood and Beverly Hills and the music industry and the film industry and the beaches. And, you know, you have very rich people and very poor people. And I live in an area of Los Angeles called the San Fernando Valley, which is a big valley that... Frank Zappa's daughter put on the map, making fun of with a song called Valley Girl back in, I think, the 80s or 90s, 80s maybe. That's LA in a nutshell.
Yeah, I've heard of the valley. I think there was in the 90s or late 80s? There was a comedy called Valley Guy, wasn't it? But they had to change the international title to, Three Days in the Valley. That's what I'm thinking of. Yeah, Three Days in the Valley. I think Terry Hatcher was in that.
Okay.
I can remember. Yeah. And there was another one that they had to rename from Encino Man to Valley. LA Man, wasn't it?
I think I remember Encino Man. Maybe you picked that name. And it's been, you know, the valley too. If you listen to some lyrics of songs and stuff, they'll mention like places in the valley, like Tom Petty, things about Reseda. Reseda is an area close to where I live. And in one of his songs, he talks about Reseda. And you'll hear it because there are so many musical artists that, especially, I don't know if you've heard of like the whole Laurel Canyon music scene that was going on, which is kind of part, it's between the San Fernando Valley and when you, it's a canyon that goes over to West LA, but a lot of musicians lived here. And so the San Fernando Valley will come up in lyrics of songs. Yeah. So it's okay. It's a good place. My home. All homes are good. I lived in Tokyo. That was a good place.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. We'll talk about that. But I want to know more about the valley because, you know, from what I know of the valley is it's more cool than it used to be, or it was not cool, or what was the thing about it?
That's pretty perceptive. Yeah. The valleys, when I grew up in the valley, it was still very suburban and a little bit rural because it used to be just fields. It was just orange groves, you know, back in the 1930s, 1940s. And after World War II, a lot of the American vets that were like in their 20s, 30s, and so on, started, you know, they were looking for suburbs. And in the 1950s, the Valley became a huge suburb of Los Angeles. So growing up, it definitely, of course, when I was growing up, I didn't know what was cool and what wasn't when you're, you know, 8 years old or 9 years old. But later on in high school, I quite realized how uncool I was. Living where I was, I remember that, you know, it's different now, but at that time we didn't have any diversity. I mean, we basically, it was probably a predominantly white area. We had some Latinos that lived, if you can imagine, they lived in particular areas. We had some African Americans, some Blacks that lived like in Pacoima in particular areas. We had no, except for some Mexican restaurants, we had really no diversity. So the first time when I was in high school, when I was about 17 or 18, and I wanted to have Thai food, I actually had to drive over to Hollywood to eat Thai food. And now you could take a rock, a stone, and throw, you'll hit a Thai restaurant. You know, they're like every block now, they have Thai restaurants. So it was pretty, I guess you could say, uncool. I don't know if I would call it cool. Now, it's big, it's crowded, it's diverse. It's not how it was when I was a kid. We have, like, for example, Los Angeles has legalized street food, like a couple of years ago. So one of the things that I do love about this, about the San Fernando Valley, and I suppose all of Los Angeles, is that, you know, we have especially Latinos that have set up these wonderful stands all over the place. And it's a little bit reminds me, because I lived in Asia, kind of like of a night market kind of scenario. At nighttime, they set up, you know, all lit up these areas where they sell burritos and tacos and various different, you know, specialties from different parts of Latin America. But it's the valley. It's just, you know, there pretty much is everything here for me. So, for example, I love diversity, and very close, like a mile from my house or so, I have a Korean market. We have Asian markets. There's a Armenian, a Russian market. Hear all different languages spoken, all different types of cuisines. So, yeah, you know, I don't know if I would call that hip, but for me, it's hip. For me, it's cool. I just, because for someone that has lived and traveled all over the world, it's wonderful being in my hometown and not having it when I was growing up, but having that now is, to me, is like wonderful.
Well, I really get you there. Growing up in rural Ireland in the 1980s, there was no diversity. Me and we do have some Italians. A lot of Italians came to Ireland in the 40s and 50s, and maybe even before that. And they, you know, they set up restaurants and, you know, English and Germans, but that's hardly diverse. But now when I go to my hometown and, you know, we have so many different nationalities and Chinese restaurants, you know, my wife is Japanese. So when she goes to my hometown, the only people that stare at her other Asian people, so they're like, who is this Asian person? We don't know this Asian person. What's she doing? Why is she here? It's kind of like the situation when you go to rural Japan and you see another gaijin, you know. It's like,
that's right,
when you first come here, you're like, who are you, what are you doing here? And you try not to do that.
It is, yeah, especially in the rural parts because, I didn't get that so much in Tokyo because even when I lived in Tokyo way back when, there were a lot of gaijins. But when I've lived in and spent time in rural Thailand, and I stick out among the Thais in rural Thailand, you know. But if I see a foreigner, you know, I usually stop and, hey, where did you come from? It's kind of like they landed, you know, moon landing, alien sighting to see a... Farang, as they say, is a Farang is a gaiji in Thai.
Absolutely. So I think, you know, we're of the same mind there that maybe we came from a place that's not so culturally diverse. We wanted to kind of see the world. It took a little bit longer for me, maybe in my mid-30s. But so you grew up in LA, you went to university in LA, and then what happened next? You went traveling.
Yeah. Well, it started off, I go way back. I was born, came out of my mother's womb. No, I won't go into that far back. I had an interest in traveling. So I grew up in a very kind of lower middle class neighborhood. And, you know, we never went anywhere. I'd never even been to the city of LA. And my dad was born in Palestine. I say Palestine because at that time it wasn't Israel. My dad was born under the British mandate of Palestine in 1920 and then left in 1939. So he was from that area and his mom lived there, my grandmother. So when I was 9 years old, and that goes all the way back to 1970, I took my first trip. My dad needed to see his mom. And so my dad didn't like to travel alone. So he, even though there were six kids in our family, he grabbed me, chose me, the chosen one. And from that time on, just being in the Middle East in 1970, we also had an opportunity to see Rome in London. As a nine-year-old, I was just enthralled. I was hooked. And that really was when I had caught the bug of, I guess it made me different than my other siblings and certainly the kids in my neighborhood, in my school. That was the beginning. And then I did a lot of backpacking, as maybe you had done or maybe you hadn't, but how a lot of ESL teachers end up teaching ESL. I had a backpack and I backpacked Europe a couple of times, North Africa. Then I did Africa overland from Egypt down to the Sudan, through Ethiopia into Kenya. And then eventually I ended up long-winded way to get to your question. I went to university, studied psychology, and not long afterwards ended up in Japan teaching in the 1980s.
So you went on an early grand tour. You went to Rome. I don't know if Palestine, Jerusalem was on the grand tour back then, but you know, you went to such iconic places so young. Well, what kind of impression did that have on you?
Yeah, I was really lucky because, again, I did not come from what I call like a sophisticated or educated family or a well-traveled. Well, my dad, I guess, would have been kind of well-traveled from just his background and where he was from. But the impressions were the first thing was just the excitement, you know, just like, whoa, this is. And also, you got to remember, I came from a big Irish family. My mom was Irish German, but my brother-in-law came from Ireland and had 12 brothers and sisters. So I didn't have anything like that. You know, there's six of us. And so, so where was I getting to?
I
went over there and it was just incredibly exciting. I remember, you know, of course, I experienced, you know, the exhaustion, the jet lag. And in those days, it just took a lot longer. It's not like now. First of all, you know, it was a lot more formal. I remember I had to dress up. You know, I think my dad wore a tie. You know, I mean, it was a different, even how people dressed to go on a plane. It was a very formal thing. And it was not many people did it. It was very expensive. And so it's not like now where, you know, so many people can travel. Not many people did. I remember the exhaustion, the excitement, the jet lag. I remember, when I got to Israel, just hearing the different languages and the excitement of just being in the Middle East, hearing Arabic, hearing, Hebrew. At that time, too, there were a lot of, in 1970, there were a lot of Holocaust survivors. They were still young. Mm. So there was a lot of that that at the time I didn't know. But as an adult reminiscing and realizing the people that I had met, you know, came from the background of being in the Holocaust, because at that time, 1970, these people were still young, like in their 40s, 50s, maybe some of them even in their 30s, you know, at that time. And so, yeah, and then, you know, Rome and London and hearing a different accent of English spoken and the artwork, you know, even at that age to be exposed to, you know, like the Vatican and the Sistine Chapel. To say it left an impression on me is just an understatement. I mean, it was for me, it was transformational. And it was so transformational. I used to daydream, come back to Canoga Park, California, where I grew up, this little cow town, little suburb. And I would actually, as a nine-year-old, I would get on, you know, we'd had a dryer, electric washing machine and dryer that went, you know, it made the humming sound. I used to get on top of it and pretend I was in an airplane, you know, on a jet.
People are doing that now, I think. Again.
Yeah, yeah. Get me out of here. It's like, you know, I wanted to get away from, you know, my brothers and sisters, you know, my older bully brother who, you know, I'm best friends now. I wanted to get away from school, kind of, you know, my house. So I used to, you know, daydream about, you know, this escape, you know, to get out and to be somewhere different. And that was the beginning of it. And by, you know, you're 9 years old and it's a hop, skip and a jump to being 16 or 17 when you, you know, you have the independence, or at least I did, to be able to go off and do some of the journeys on my own. Just, you know, maybe.
And you went on the Nile. It was this kind of Hercule Poirot style, or was it
No, it was pretty rough in it. It was more like how to avoid dysentery in, like, you know, three different ways. It was more like how not to die in Africa. It was a pretty rough trip. And then when I was in Kenya, there was a attempted coup. The Air Force tried to take over the government, and there was it was a curfew. There was a state of emergency. There were shootings, people dead on the street. It was just insane. So, yeah. So when I got back to LA, I had one more semester of university. And it was the worst semester I had because I just couldn't relate to my classes. After what I experienced in Africa, it just seemed so sterile. It seemed so... what do they call it? Like being in your ivory tower, you know, didn't seem real. And so I struggled through just to get through my last semester and graduate, but you know, the Africa trip really, made being alive on this earth real.
And then you went to Tokyo. Is that right?
I did.
Straight after. Basically, you graduated and got on the plane, was it?
A couple of years.
Oh, okay.
A couple of years. Yeah, I had to, you know, I mean, the economy was terrible here in the U.S. at that time.
What year was this, Dave?
I would have been, let's see, I graduated in 1983.
Ah, okay.
So it would have been, I'm sorry, I graduated in 82. So, yeah, in December of 82, so like 83, 84. So even though I had a university degree and I did well in school, the only job I could get steadily was being a courier. So if you know what a courier is, so I guess it's the equivalent now of being like an Uber driver. But I used to deliver. I worked for a travel agency where I had to deliver airline tickets. So it's like these are things that aren't even relevant now. But you know, like some of your audience is like, what's a travel agency? What's an airline ticket?
Yeah, I know. Bicycle courier and bike courier, and yeah,
those don't exist anymore. So it was a corporate travel agency, and my job was to get these tickets out to these companies, these corporations like ASAP. They'd be like, there was like a corporation. We had a telephone company across the street, Pacific Bell, and Bechtel Corporation. All these corporations, and you know, these travel agents would be hurrying, getting these tickets so that they could fly to whatever, you know, get out to the Middle East or London ASAP, and they'd book a ticket and they'd give it to me. And I'd literally have to, you know, get in my car, or if it was downtown, I'd have to run. I was a good runner. I'd run it over because I had to get it to them so that they could get to the airport. and make their flight. And it was a blast. I loved it. It was kind of like, well, it was better than like being an accountant.
Yeah, well, and yeah, to all the accountants out there, that's...
No offense. Disclaimer. But it was fun, and I lasted a couple of years, and I didn't make any money. I paid rent, you know, I made rent, made a little bit of spending money, and had a good time. And I knew about Japan. We had you probably know, living in Tokyo. Do you know of a bookstore called Kinokuniya?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, in Shinjuku.
Okay, we have a Kinokuniya in Los Angeles.
There's Oh, I didn't know that. Wow, that's really interesting. Okay, yeah. for Japanese speakers, is it or is and, it a
yeah?
For, okay.
Well, they have a section like quite a large section of English books, but most of them are relevant to Japan. So it could be anything from Japanese language learning material to books on Japan, guidebooks, ikebana, you know, whatever.
For those that don't know, Kinokuniya is a it's probably the leading English bookshop in Tokyo. I mean, there are a few others, but if you want to get your English books, you go there. But now, of course, Amazon, you can just...
It's
too easy. But back then, you could, you know, when you landed in Tokyo, it was a lifeline, wasn't it? You probably could get like newspapers from back home and...
It's almost hard to comprehend because things have changed so much. I mean, I feel really that, you know, I use a Kindle, so I read a lot. So I get book after book after book after book. Any book I want, boom, within seconds. Music, you know, I'm not putting it. I love streaming and I stream everything. So I'm not anti-streaming. It's just excessive. Like, for example, if I like a group, if I like, for example, I'm going to date myself, Pink Floyd. But it doesn't have to. It could be Billie Eilish to get a little bit more contemporary. But in the old days, it was a big deal. I had to save up my money. I knew that the latest Pink Floyd, The Wall, was going to be coming out. I'd save my money. It'd be released. I'd go out to the record store. I'd buy it. And I'd listen to the lyrics. And now I don't even have the focus to listen to one album fully. And so, but I know I'm getting way off the point. But the point is, yes, back in the day when I lived in Japan, Kinokuniya really was a lifeline for books, just as like Roppongi for me was kind of a lifeline for maybe the expat at that time. I don't know what Roppongi is like now, but it was kind of lifeline. Yeah, at that time it was pretty cool. It was the '80s, man. You know, it was great. They had these bars that spilled outside with talking heads, music playing, and you had European bartenders that were like really cool. And it was kind of a neat place. Not all of it, but it was fun. I had some, you know, good expat times over there back then. But it was kind of a lifeline to kind of momentarily get away from the culture.
Yeah, I'm being a bit unfair on Roppongi. Of course, it's very mixed. It's got some very nice museums, some very nice restaurants, nice park. But it also has kind of a seedy, touty area, and there's a lot of what they call botakuri, isn't that right? It's basically spiking your drink, and and it's mostly for most of the bars are frequented by foreigners, aren't they? From what I remember, I never go to Roppongi. I just I don't work there, so I don't have any reason.
It has to have changed tremendously. I know it has, because there's lots of areas of Japan that have changed. I've been to Tokyo, not. Well, since I left, I've taken my kids a couple times. I mean, I've had some trips back, maybe the last trip like 4, 5, 6 years ago. I don't remember. But like Akihabara has changed. A lot of the areas have changed. I used to live in an area. My last apartment was in an area called Sakura Shinmachi, which was, God, if I remember this, on the Akuba. Oh, it's not right. Akuba line. I don't remember.
I don't know that station. Sorry. Where is it?
It's in Setagaya.
Okay.
It's Shinjuku.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, you get off the subway stop, and it was just all in order to walk to my apartment. It was just all these old fashioned mom and pop like food stands and, you know, like fruit chops, meat chops, little old fashioned, you know, Japanese restaurants, ramen, you know, and so on. It was really quaint. And I went back there some years ago, not that long ago, maybe 5 years ago. I couldn't recognize it. It was all the mom and pop shops were gone. And it had all, we have an expression here that is called gentrification. And so it's where, you know, there were hip shops, you know, vintage clothing, vintage watch shops and hip coffee shops and so on. And I couldn't believe it. I go, wow, I guess all the old generation must have passed away. They're not around anymore. You know, the World War II generation. So I realized then that a lot of Tokyo had really changed tremendously from like the days that I lived there, because it's a way completely different generation of people. A lot of the people that I knew, the World War II population, they were still relatively young, you know, like some of them even in their 50s, but certainly in their 60s, not much older than me or my age. So it's a very different country and city anyway than it was when I was there in the 1980s.
Yeah, and it changed a lot from the 60s as well. If you know Phil Knight's book, the founder of Nike, he talks about dealing with or coming to Japan in the 60s, and you know, areas of Japan or Tokyo weren't even lit 20 years after the war. But you know, things took off in 60s, 70s, right. And of course, you arrived during the boom economy. Now,
I did.
I think if we look online, John Pilger, the journalist, he has a good documentary. I'll put it in the show notes about Japan in the 80s and the high spending, high life, hyperinflation economy, wasn't there? It was famous for. What was it? You had to pay like $250,000 to join a golf club, and also. So, what kind of stories? What kind of things did you experience in Tokyo during the boom economy?
Yeah, it was like the place to be, you know, in the world. I mean, it really just felt like the center of the universe, center of, you know, the earth. It was just, you know, a bit of a gold rush, you know, kind of mentality that was going on. And of course, you had a lot of people that were there for English teaching, but people, you know, it could be anything from, you know, women that would go over and even be, you know, work in hostess clubs, lots and lots of foreign models. I mean, I worked, in fact, below a big modeling agency in Omotesando, and I thought, I'd look in the mirror and I'd go, God, am I ugly? Look at these beautiful people coming out. I mean, this short, you know, short, funny looking guy. And I go, I don't know, maybe I could model socks. My feet are pretty nice. You know, it was just, you know, there was a lot of extravagance. A lot at that time, the Japanese fashion industry, Hanae Mori, and see if my mind is going to go blank. It has.
So for those listening, we'll just so Shinjuku is kind of a mixed business. What would we say, downtown area? When we talk about Akihabara, Akihabara is we would say it's electronic town, but it's changed. It used to be you could pick up electronic goods and parts and plugs and fuses, but now it's changed more anime and K-pop, J-pop, that sort of thing. So it changed a little bit there. We talk about Roppongi, it's more kind of the foreign areas we mentioned before. Omotesando is I can't remember what the equivalent would be in New York, but in
It could be like
Oxford Street, maybe in London.
Champs-Élysées. It's a very kind of wide, beautiful street with a lot of trees, a lot of very fashionable shops. It's very kind of high fashion, or at least it used to be. And then it leads into Harajuku, and Harajuku is more of like a teen kind of, you know, yeah, it's like a teenager type of place. It's where like my teenage daughter, well, she's not a teenage daughter anymore. She's 24, almost 25. But when she was a teenager, that's where she wanted to go. You know, she wanted to go to Harajuku. Harajuku was for the fun, you know, funky teenage stuff. And then Omote Sando is where my wife would shop for something nice, you know. I would tell her we can't afford it.
Yeah, Omote Sando is that kind of place. It's got a, what would we say, when you go in the back streets of Omote Sando and the hair salons, they're probably three times the price of other places. Yeah. I think there's a lot of wedding chapels or faux wedding chapels there as well. People like to say they got married in Omote Sando. It has a certain prestige, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know that. What? Yeah. Yeah. It's, well, again, Tokyo, I think any city is just really fascinating. I really have not, I don't think there's such thing as a boring place. I'm always able to find even places that are supposed to be just like, oh, awful, don't go there. I usually can discover, even amongst quote unquote ugliness, I can usually find some like diamonds in the rough, you know, if you have an open mind and you're willing to explore. But Tokyo, again, Tokyo's a little bit like LA, where it's endlessly fascinating. LA, like Tokyo, you could spend your whole life exploring and not see it all. Not, you know, it's again, Tokyo's just vast.
It's vast and it's safe, mostly, except for strange crimes that happen that you can read online that you can, like, well, I'm not going to get into that, but
it is. It's safe. It's one of the things I do, you know, love about Japan. And, you know, of course, Japan is very clean. It's fantastic for people that haven't been to Asia before. I think it's a really nice kind of get your feet wet. To start out, especially for somebody perhaps that's a little bit less adventurous, I think Japan's a wonderful introduction to Asia, you know. And I love it. I mean, I lived there for 5 years, and then I was luckily able to spend about 3 or 4 years ago, I spent a month in an Airbnb with my kids in Kyoto, and that was wonderful.
Wow, I can imagine some of those on Airbnb. Amazing house. But now Kyoto has gone bankrupt, unfortunately, because of the lack of tourists.
A lot of the places in the world, Thailand, because I have ties. My wife's from Thailand. I have ties.
You have ties to Thais.
No, I didn't mean it. I wasn't supposed to come out like that. I have ties in Thailand.
So tell me, Dave, so you started off in Tokyo. Where did you first get a job?
I got a job working for, it was a school. What was it called? I think I had two names, but essentially, I don't even remember the name, but essentially one component of the school was an English conversation school that was above the McDonald's, Makudonarudo, as I say in Japanese, the McDonald's above, I mean, the office above the McDonald's in Omote Sando, on the, whatever the street's name is. And that was just teaching. It was teaching English conversation. You know, I mean, it was pretty easy teaching. I mean, you know, I don't even think we had text. It was so crazy. I think a lot of times I was just supposed to have conversation. It was like a little bit like a conversation lounge. I was supposed to, I wasn't really teaching much, but that's how it was in the 80s. And I taught some businessmen, and then a separate component of this organization was they had a school in Meguro, and it was kind of, they called it like English Language College or something like that. And it was kind of prepping students for TOEFL for going to the US, you know, to study abroad. And, I did that. It was, you know, and then a lot of English teachers, part-time jobs here, part-time jobs there. Students that would come to my house, you know, I did that. And then later on, I was actually married. Ta-da! I usually don't talk about my personal life in that area, but I was married to a Japanese and I'm divorced now. And so we had formed a school together in Tokyo called English Studio. So for the first year that I lived in Japan, I was working all over the city just as a teacher. And then for the next 3 years or so, I was a co-owner, teacher, businessman of an English language school in Tokyo.
Wow. So what age were you? Early 20s?
Yeah, let's see. I went to Japan when I was 24. We started the school when I was 24, just as I was going to turn 25. We had started it like in January of 1986. And it was great. Yeah, it was exciting. It was fun. It was at the time, we were very entrepreneurial, and we were just, you know, like when we were teaching, it's like, we could do this. You know, we were really kind of cocky. When you're in your 20s, you have a lot of confidence, and, you know, and then luckily it turned out well. We kind of knew what we were doing. We were able to get a really good location, and we were on near Tamachi Station, near Keio University. It was an old house built in the 1920s that faced the main street, and we were able to put on neon sign, English studio, and had flyers printed up and put in the newspapers, and it took off. Yeah, I mean, it took off. We did pretty well, and and I had a lot of, you know, that was my early really business experience, you know, so I didn't really know what I was doing, but I could sell to get students in. I could teach, I could hire teachers. And you know, that was the beginning. I'm not a very good manager. I didn't like management, but I was an entrepreneur. I kind of had ideas, and that's kind of what I am. I'm a terrible manager. I can't manage my dogs and my cats. So,
so 25, 26, starting a business, you know, you had the bravado maybe and the confidence, but,
yeah, right. You do.
Where did it go wrong in that? Not that the business went wrong, but what mistakes did you make?
Well, any kind of relationship's difficult, you know, and even friendships can be difficult, and, you know, and certainly any kind of significant other relationship, whether it's a living girlfriend or boyfriend, certainly marriage. I don't say we rushed into it, but I think there was a lot of stress running the business together. I think we in the beginning, we actually lived in one of the schools. So we're living in a school, we had a school going on, running a business. It's stressful. You know, I mean, it's not like teaching is not really stressful for the most part. You know, I mean, it can be. But
maybe in a high school, or, you know, it's stressful, isn't it?
Yeah, it can be stressful depending, you know, but if you have experience teaching, you can balance it. But when you run a business, you have, you know, not just the bills to pay that, you know, teachers, they later on, the growth, hiring teachers quitting on you at the last minute, hiring a teacher, but them not showing up and accepting a job at another place. Students that are complaining, it goes to you, you know. Being competitive, I think both of us being young, we probably both had egos. I know that I did. I don't, at the time I didn't think so, but now I realize now that, you know, yeah. It's like, hey, I want to be in charge. You know, and I think when you have two people like that, anytime you have that kind of friction, that kind of headbutting, it's a problem both for the business and, of course, for the marriage. And so it just broke down. It's just, yeah, I mean, you know, when they say it was kind of meant to be, really, because, you know, like when one thing ends, you think it's a catastrophe, and then you end up going in a different direction, meeting someone else, going to do something differently. And it ends up kind of like it was just fate. It was meant to go in that direction. You know, I mean, but at the time it was very traumatic, but it was a very good thing for both of us. And I think both of us went on, you know, went on to happier lives. I hope so anyway, or I have.
Seems amicable enough. We won't go there too much. Yeah. So how long were you in Tokyo? How many years?
Well, I was there total of about 5 years. So I was there 4 years. And then after I got married in Thailand, I got married in 1989. I didn't wait till I got divorced in 88 and married in 1989.
Can you rewind a little bit? So I'd like to know about how you got to Thailand from Tokyo.
I swam. Well, as my marriage was breaking down, I wasn't in the best emotional and psychological state. I have tools now that, you know, it's funny because I just turned 60 this year, and honest to God,
you're looking well for 60.
Thank you. Well, I would rather be 60 at this time in my life than, you know, like 28 at the time that I was at 28, 29. I'm physically better, emotionally better, I'm balanced. But at that time, I think there was a lot going on. I did not handle stress or anxiety very well. And I had a lot of outbursts. And I was in Roppongi, speaking of which, drinking copious amounts of alcohol, which I don't drink anymore. And a bartender, I think he was from Sweden, you know, he said, he knew me. And he said, Dave, I was, you know, he was my psychologist, my therapist. And I was, you know, complaining to him. And he goes, Dave, one word. But what is it? He said, Thailand.
Sounds like, you know, in The Graduate when they say to Dustin Hoffman, plastics.
Yeah, but that hasn't fared the earth too well, has it?
No.
My daughter hates that line. but it was like that. He said, Thailand. And so the next day, in my hungover state, I realized I needed some time away. I needed to get out of Japan. I needed to separate. I needed to clear my head. And I had friends in Thailand, Thai friends as well from school. So I bought a ticket, got a Thai visa, and about literally 3 days later, I was on a plane to Bangkok. And I spent a couple of months there. I just checked. I have my old passport. It's so many years ago. I go, how long was it? I must have been only 3 weeks. Wow, I was gone like 2 months. I was there for 2 months and I fell in love with the country. Absolutely just, you know, head over heels. I just love the Thai people, love the Southeast Asian culture, the Buddhism, the climate. I loved everything, the food. At that time, my wife, ex-wife had filed for divorce. So I went back, went through the whole divorce proceedings. And then when it was over, came back to LA to see my parents. And then on a plane to Thailand, you know, decided to take some time off and live there.
You had a little bit of money from selling the school. Did you have a nice exit?
You're very perceptive. That's exactly it. Otherwise, yeah, I had something like the equivalent of about 30,000 US dollars, which is probably worth a lot more. That was 1988 dollars. So it's definitely worth a lot more.
That would have gone a long way in Thailand in 88.
A long way. So, so I had some money in the bank. So what I did was I moved to Thailand. I started off, I rented an apartment, and then later on I rented a house. Bought a motorcycle. I love motorcycling. So I bought a motorcycle, I'm a avid photographer, or at least I used to be, not so much anymore. And bought some not really good Canon camera equipment and worked on my photography, worked on my writing. I was a bit of a wannabe Hemingway that never turned into anything, but started doing some writing, music, catching up on all the music I missed, like Talking Heads. Who are the Talking Heads? I missed years and years of music that I just, you know, I wasn't aware of. And so caught up on my music, studied Thai, met my wife, met a lot of friends, traveled by motorcycle with my wife all over the country. And it was just, it was the best year of my life. Absolutely. Yeah, I'd say from 1988 to 1989 was the absolute best year. I mean, I've had a lot of good years, but it was just, when I look back, it was just, I can call it a magical year. It was a really, really magical year for me.
We can all remember 88. Well, it's, those of us that were born can remember, you know, the Carl Lewis and Ben Johnson race in 88. And then, of course, 89, we remember, you know, the Berlin Wall came down. So it was, we know where we were at that time. And for you, was obviously a special year. So you eventually settled down a little bit. You got a job. Did you start a school, settle down, work for
another school? after I got married, I got a call from a friend of mine, a Japanese friend, who he was a printer, and he had a school that he set up for his daughter, and she was young, like only about 21 or something like that, and had it for a year, and she didn't really want to do it anymore. So he called me up and asked me if I wanted to come over and take it over, and I said, yeah. So my wife and I, my new wife, not new anymore, we've been married 32 years.
Wow, congratulations.
So this time it worked out. But we went off to Japan. But by the time we got there, it all fell apart because there just were no students. The whole thing had fallen apart. So I managed to get a job as a manager for a new school, startup school. I think it was in Shimomeguro, I think is where it was, Shimomeguro. And it was a new school called English Loft. They were just starting it, and they needed someone that knew how to kind of, like, I used the experience that I learned from starting English Studio, the years that I had there, to start up that school. So I did a combination of, it wasn't much management. I hired a couple of teachers, but there were a couple of great Canadians that were just, I didn't manage them. They were wonderful guys that, we were three buddies that had a great time together.
You can't beat the Canadians, can you?
You can't. These were really, really cool guys. I really loved them. And we had a great time together, a lot of really good experiences. And it was just kind of, you know, coordinating classes, getting the advertising going. I did a little bit of teaching. It was, you know, it was a fun year. It was an easy year. And the boss, the guy who owned the school, was really, really nice. And I did that for a year. And then my wife and I were starting to get homesick for Thailand, you know. You were listening to a lot of Thai music, and we were just getting homesick. So we went back to Thailand. And on the second day back, my wife realized that she was pregnant. You know, she knew something was amiss, and got a pregnancy test, and the honeymoon was over. So
things started getting serious. You know, you have to live a proper life.
Life was a changing. That 1988-89 free flow magical year was coming to an end. So, you know, so I had marriage, a kid on the way, and it was, you know, some big changes. I had to get a real job. I worked, got a job as an English language teacher for a really great school called AUA, the American University Alumni something or another. So it's one of the better schools. It's still there. It's still around, and it's an excellent school still. I was lucky to get there, get a full-time position there to teach, and I taught there the whole time, the remaining years I was there.
So then Dave's ESL Cafe, how did the idea come about? What was the...
Well, going back a little bit, well, when I got back to the U.S., I didn't know. I was actually supposed to I had studied psychology. I was supposed to go into clinical psychology. So I was starting, I started a doctoral program in clinical psych, and it wasn't for me. So I decided, well, I love ESL. You know, I love ESL. So I went back to school for, what did I get my degree in? One of those ambiguous degrees. I think they call it a Bachelor of Science in Applied Linguistics, which is, you know, it's just what they called it. But it was kind of like, it was linguistics, kind of more focused on second language acquisition, ESL. I spent a couple years in school and also teaching ESL. And then at the end of that, it was the beginning of kind of like the internet craze, you know, like it was the 90s, and it was just, you know, people were just starting to get, like, people that were computer phobic or not into computers, like
the information superhighway, the World Wide Web, we remember in the early 90s.
Just starting. Most people in the early 90s weren't quite there yet, but you know, you had I think Mac was a big thing. So, you know, you had Mac, and with an Apple, it just made it really easy. It was just like, I bought my first Apple in 93. And I fell in love. I go, oh, the computers are great. You know, I take my little mouse. Oh, it's so cute. I could, you know, I could configure it so that when I empty the trash, I could hear a toilet flush sound. I go, oh, so much fun.
93. I think my school had those computers. If I remember, there was a program to teach you how to use a mouse on it, how to drag the stuff. Do you remember that on the Mac? They bought,
Yeah, there were all kinds of things. There were fun programs like, Super Mario teaches typing, and, you know, I mean, it was compared to now, it was pretty primitive, you know, but it was compared to perhaps like Windows or DOS. It was at that time, you know, they had DOS, which was, you know, very cryptic. It was beautiful. It was an amazing, fun machine. And with that, I was able to connect to the internet. It came with a modem, and I figured it out, and I was able to actually
like connect. 28K or 56K. Was it about
that? Yeah, it was dial up. Like 28. Yeah, it was dial up 28K, and I think it was AOL, America Online. But
Netscape after that, and Gateway computers. Yeah,
That came about around. Let's see. Came around about 95. So one of my friends who happens to be from Thailand was a doctoral student in computer science at USC. And he called me up and he said, oh, you got to see. At the time, it was called Mosaic. And Mosaic was the visual. It's kind of like what we know now as the World Wide Web, as we see it, a graphical World Wide Web. Before it was just text, it was you had to go on the something like Telnet and put in commands, and you could get to the World Wide Web, but it was just, there were no pictures or images or anything like that. Not like we know it today. And he says, you got to come over here. You got to drive over here and see this. This is just, it'll blow you away. So I drove over to downtown USC and went to the computer lab, and he showed me Mosaic, which is pretty, it was probably kind of a crude version of, you know, like later on it became, I think it became, or at least for me, it became Netscape. Maybe that's what it did become. I don't know. But that was the beginning. And I saw that and I go, this is cool. I go, oh yeah, this is going to transform the internet. So when I got back, he told me to read, you know, he gave me a book on HTML, hypertext markup language, so I could create my own web page. And that was the beginning of Dave's ESL Cafe. I began to teach myself how to code HTML in 1995 after I finished grad school. And that was the background of how, you know, the site came to be. It was just really kind of an experiment of just creating. I started off creating a web page for my students. It was a writing project with pictures and had them write. And it was a publishing project. And my students got email addresses from the university, published it. And then that was December. And then in January, these students were receiving KeyPal messages. They were making friends from all over the world. And people were reading this page. We were reaching people from all over the world. It was easy to get attention back then. Not like now, not like we didn't know Google wasn't even around. I mean, it was really easy to.
There was no Facebook to friend people or, you know, LinkedIn network. Yeah. No,
you know, you had these like user groups and you would just say like, oh, you know, these teacher groups are, you know, key. Hey, check out our webpage. You know, it would be like these user groups, kind of like, you know, forums, but.
Chat rooms that you have at that time. Yeah.
Like that. A lot of it was still text-based. It wasn't forums. It was like they had these Usenet groups. And, you know, we posted just kind of on these Usenet groups and for ESL and teaching and stuff. And yeah, and that was the beginning. I realized that, wow, this is really powerful because maybe for the first time in history, we can self-publish whatever we want and it can reach a global audience. You know, it's not just like a pamphlet that we're handing out at the train station. I mean, you know, this, we can publish something with images, whatever we want. So to me, that was cool. And then again, it was also the graphical part of it because, you know, I could make it visual, and that visualization to me was really important. I could put colors, I could pictures. Later on, I learned how to make it interactive with things like forums or, you know, different. I had some, well, a lot of it has changed. I always say I had a lot of imagination then. It was a good time to, I would say, anybody out there, 20s and 30s are a fantastic time. I don't know. I mean, everybody's different. I mean, my dad had a lot of imagination in his 50s and 60s, and that's when he was at his peak. But for me, really, my 20s and 30s were my peak, and I call my imaginative peak and my energetic levels. And I created a lot of, I just had all these ideas, graffiti wall, question and answer page, idea cookbook. I had all these ideas, and I would put them all together, and eventually it became a website, which really wasn't quite an expression back then, which it is now. It was just a series of web pages that I integrated into one menu, one page that became Dave's ESL Cafe. And that's how it started.
What would you put your early success down to? Was it you had a first mover advantage, or you'd built a community around it?
Well, the first thing of success was I loved it. It was fun. You know, it was just, I felt like it was groundbreaking. It was fun. It was, you know, revolutionary. It was an ego trip in a way. Sure. You know, I mean, just like somebody now posts this picture on Facebook and like, oh, wow. Yeah. You know, people, oh, I love your page. You know, I love it. Yeah. You know, I was getting a lot of encouragement. And that encouragement motivated me to create more. And I was just having a lot of fun with it. And then I was invited to conferences, and it very quickly. So I went to TESOL International Conference in Chicago, and I think with the spring of 1996. And then I started meeting people and meeting other people that were doing like kind of similar things to what I was doing. And so, yeah, a part of it was just this, incredible focus and creativity, and just, it was just my life. That's number one. Number two, yeah, being at the right time. Yeah, because again, there really wasn't much like it at that time. So I had that advantage. And then the third, in terms of the business side of it, was losing money was, and it was advantageous. It was a motivator to think about either closing the site down or coming up with ideas to fund it.
So tell me about the costs of starting a site back then. Were they much higher than now, or? Yeah.
Much, much higher. Yeah. Well, the first cost was the time element that I was putting into it. And, you know, my son at that time. When I started Dave's ESL Cafe, he would have been 5 in kindergarten. My daughter wasn't born yet, but she was born literally a year later, or so in January of 97. So there was the cost of all the hours I put into the work. And mind you, I was teaching full time too, so I was teaching. All the hours I was putting into Dave's ESL Cafe was also a vacuum away from my family. You know, and do I regret that now? Well, maybe. I don't know. It was what I had to do at that time. It was just, you know, it was where I was at that time. At this point in my life, if I'm at the same situation, I probably wouldn't have done it. I probably would have put my priority with my family and not money, and just taught and been happy with what I had. But that's where I was at that time. And so what was the question?
Yeah, about the costs of running a website. The yeah, there was the time cost, obviously. Yeah,
Family, see what family does. Then there was the financial cost. So we had something called bandwidth, which you don't really have to worry about now. You know, a lot of times it's just like unlimited bandwidth for like, you know, it's definitely, if you're paying bandwidth, you don't have to. It's very easy to find like unlimited bandwidth, not to even have to worry about that. But at that time, it was not like that. And I was getting excess over bandwidth charges that were, they were getting into the hundreds and then later into, you know, like a couple thousand dollars extra per month. Really? And I was only I wasn't making very much. I was lucky if I was making $3,000 a month, before taxes, and then you take taxes out of that. And if you get an internet bill that came out to like $1,500, I mean, I was
a shocker.
Yeah. I had like the manager call me up. I had just come from Thailand and had just come back, and he called me up and said, look, he goes, we're going to, you know, we have to charge this much for bandwidth. Now, mind you, it was just different. Now it's not like you can go online and look around. It's just, maybe you could have, I don't know, but it was just at the time I thought, okay, I have a few different options. One is I could try to get funding, like university funding. But I'm not a, I found that my university was very bureaucratic, and I didn't want to, like, you know, if I need extra pencils, I had to go through 10 different signatures to get, you know, chalk for the chalkboard, that kind of thing. There was no way that I wanted the university to have any say in my creativity and what I was doing with Dave's ESL Cafe. So that was out. So then I thought, okay, how about selling banner advertising? I had a lot of requests. So I did that. And that first year, I broke even. I was able to kind of pay the costs and maybe a tiny bit more profit.
Now, this is a I really want to continue this, but I just want to ask a little bit. What was where did people advertise before your site came on? Was it student magazines in universities? How was advertising done?
Yeah. It was mostly print ad. Just like in Japan, the way I hired teachers back and the way I was able to get a job. And I don't know if it's changed now. Maybe it has. Maybe it hasn't. But in those days, I would get the Japan Times on a Monday, and then they had the classifieds, and I'd either advertise when I was a manager or running school to get teachers, or if I was a teacher looking for a job, I would go to a phone booth. I guess people know what a phone booth is, right?
Yeah. So I go to I think they're porter. They're mini libraries now, aren't they?
Yeah, right.
Places, yeah.
So I'd go into a phone booth in the midst of winter. Hello, I'm interested in the teaching English. It's snowing outside and the wind blowing. But anyways, that's how people advertised in newspapers, magazines. Recruitment was done a lot, and maybe still is, through the international TESOL conferences. I don't know. It's a, you know, I'm not really quite 100% sure, because I really wasn't, you know, as far as ESL advertising, I really wasn't cognizant of it at that time. It wasn't really something, except for hiring teachers or looking for a job. It really wasn't anything that I was, you know, part of. We had phone books, yellow pages as well, phone books for local things for schools and stuff.
Another thing people probably won't understand, yellow pages.
Yeah. It was a really different era where, you know, communication is just not like it is now. It was just very difficult to, you know, everything was reliant on print back then, even more so when you look back in histories, you know, before radio. And you start going back, I actually have a collection of like old newspapers from the 1800s and magazines and stuff like that. And you know, that they were really, truly, that was it. That was just, you know, I mean, people lived for newspapers, you know, that was how people got their news. And so, you know, it wasn't quite like that in my generation, but it was still very print oriented. You know, you didn't have Kindles, you didn't have, you know, internet. Well, even you didn't have internet, and the internet was just beginning when I started Dave's ESL Cafe. It was just the beginning.
And so the banner advertising, you people started contacting you from all over the world, or?
Yeah. All over. I mean, they had contacted me earlier, and I said, I just saved it in the mailbox. I sent them a message and said, you know, no, at this time I'm not taking advertising. And then I emailed them when I decided to make a few bucks. I sent messages out to these people and said, you know, I'm now I made a price list.
How did you come up with the price list? Because this is something people find difficult. Yeah, you just pull it out from somewhere. Who were your competitors? You know,
you know, that's a good question. I mean, I don't know. You know, I might have looked at competitors, but I probably didn't. I probably just in my own mind just thought, you know, I had top position, middle position. Top position's the most expensive. This is less expensive. This is, you know.
Sounds like print, really. Print advertising.
I pretty much just winged it and figured, okay, well, this page gets the most access. This is the main page. I'm going to charge this much. I'm pretty sure I just winged it. I'm not sure if I looked at competitors. There wasn't even then a lot of banner advertising. There was some, but not like it is now. So I'm not quite sure I looked around, but I'm not ruling that out. I might have. It's a long time ago.
So usually, on your site, you have the banner ads, don't you? And you have the links as well. So it's a little bit like the old classified ads section. You know, you have the display ad and the lineage ads. Is that the idea you had?
Yeah. How I set things up now are different. I redesigned my site, and I could talk about that a little bit later.
But, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
About a year and a half, going on 2 years ago, I redesigned my site. So everything's a little bit different, a lot different. But back then, everything was done by hand, literally. I did the coding by hand. All the changes were done by hand. Banners were put on, not literally by hand. It's not like I...
yeah, not copy and paste. Banner. You didn't have your glue pot on your desk. Yeah.
No, I didn't glue it on the computer. But I had to FTP. They would have to send me their GIF or JPEG banner, and I'd have to FTP it and get it into the right slot. You know, it was pretty primitive, but it's how I ran the site for many, many years. And so that was the beginning. I made some money. And then I thought at some point during that year or early 99, I thought, you know, I was doing the job boards, and I had been doing them since probably 96 or 97, probably 96. And it was all free.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
so you had free ads.
All job stuff was free, and I had it. I can't tell you. I had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of jobs over those years. And one day, you know, after the banner advertising, I started thinking, "Wait a minute, this shouldn't be free." I thought, I ran a school, and I never thought twice about paying to recruit teachers, to put an ad in the Japan Times. I never expected it to be free. You know, I mean, of course you paid. I didn't care what it cost. That is how I recruited teachers. I didn't even look at the cost. I mean, whatever it was, that is how I need. So I thought to myself, okay, I am going to start charging. But I was really afraid because I thought people wouldn't pay and I would not get any jobs, and the site would lose credibility. I thought it would collapse. I was really afraid. It was going into the unknown. But I decided...
This is the monetization stage, isn't it? And a lot of entrepreneurs have this hesitancy, don't they? They think, oh, my God, everybody's going to go.
Yeah, right. There's this idea that, I've spent years on this, and I was in love with the site. And it's like, I know that I have to do this. This is not right. But people aren't going to like it. I'm going to jeopardize the future, possibly jeopardize the future of the site. It needs to be done, but I was afraid. But I decided to do the groundwork that was needed to do this. The first step, which is so easy to do now, but so difficult back then, was to get a merchant account to process credit cards.
Oh, wow.
Now it's so easy. It's so easy. I got one from my wife. She's a yoga teacher, massage therapist, Pilates teacher, personal trainer, jack of all trades. And what did we use? Was it Stripe? Not Stripe. It was Square. It's called
Square.
It's called Square. And it was just minutes. I mean, she was able to get the ability to process credit cards in like 10 minutes. It was just so easy. I had to go through, you know, I practically had to promise my next born child to the bank.
I can imagine with the money laundering laws and
it was just terrible. It was just like, oh boy, what I, you know, so, but I managed to get it. And then I had to figure out how to process, you know, I got the account, how to process, how to set up a web page to do this, how to set up prices. Excuse me, while I take this bandana off? It's getting hot here in Southern California. I had to come up with the prices, and those prices were, I was looking to price the ads. How much the Los Angeles Times were, how much it was for print advertising to advertise. And that's how I came up with the price. And I think the price that I came up with, which hasn't changed, was $75 an ad, $200 for a package of four ads, $550 for a package of 12 ads. And what I was doing is I was looking at print advertising and just bringing the price really substantially down, but at the same time, not limiting the amount of letters, lines, words, or whatever you want to call it. It was unlimited, where, you know, the classified, which in those days people were still using a lot of classifieds. You know, you just could, you had to be really careful about the number of words because it was expensive and to put into an ad. But that was maybe in February that I set everything up perfectly, but I was scared to do it. I didn't change over. I said, okay, I'm going to do it in the new, you know, in January of 2000. But in April of 1999, I had a little too much whiskey one night, and I was in front of my computer about 11 p.m. and I was just testing it. I was looking at it and going, yeah, let's make sure that this thing works. So I did a test. You know, I turned it on, and then I went to the website and just tested it. It was for the Korean jobs. And then I had to go to the bathroom. So, you know, I went to the bathroom. And then brushed my teeth, put on my pajamas, and went to bed. And the next morning when I woke up, I had like $500 in sales. I forgot to turn it off. I was like, oh my God. First it was like, oh no, what have I done? Oh God, I forgot. You know, it's kind of like, forget to turn the light off. Oops. But it was like, oops, but ooh, oops, oops. God. It was, you know, that was like 1 week of teaching, you know, I was making like, you know, that was like a week of my teaching money. And it was like, oh, well, wait a minute. So I couldn't turn back now. I mean, I wasn't going to refund the money. So, so then I kept it. And then the international job board, I had another job board. They were complaining that it says, oh, the Koreans were saying it's not fair that, you know, they're getting it for free, but we Koreans are paying. So I changed it over to the other job board. At the time I had two. And then the hate mail came in.
give me an example of some hate mail.
Oh, gosh, you know, you have to have thick skin. You know, I mean, the truth is that it's, if you want to be online, have any online presence, I really feel sorry for some young people that have been bullied too, you know, that,
yeah.
You know, because you really do have to have thick skin.
I think some people think you're some kind of robber baron, some kind of Jay Gould, or because, you know, I get sometimes emails and people are saying you're trying to rip people off, you know.
Right.
Yeah, so it does happen.
Yeah, at that time, it just charging was, it was still not standardized. It was still not acceptable for, you know, and especially coming from an educational academic background that I had, it just wasn't really seen as an acceptable thing to do. And employers didn't, you know, I can't even say I lost customers because they didn't really pay, but some said, you know, I'm never going to pay. It'll always be free. Others, you know, they didn't even bat an eyelash. You know, I mean, they just paid and never said anything. New customers didn't complain.
What was the alternative? Like Craigslist would have been free.
No,
like there was no Craigslist back then.
There was one other site. It was either around my time or after, I can't remember. It was something like ESLjobs.com. Okay. That might not be the name, but it was something like that. The other alternative was, I think TESOL had a monthly publication, and I think it was print, and I think that there were jobs in that. How else was there? I mean, there really wasn't a whole lot. I mean, mind you, there might have been more than what I'm mentioning. I'm just not aware. Later, of course, they started to proliferate, a lot more. But in the beginning, there wasn't much, but I kind of just stuck with it. I mean, it was just like my dad was a businessman, and my dad just said, yeah, stick with it. My dad told me about needing to have thick skin and that, if you want to be in business. And later on, I realized it wasn't just being in business. It was just being online. Which will make you even more of a target because people are anonymous. But, the complaints were, like you said, you're greedy. Employers were saying, you shouldn't charge. It should be free. I'm going to go to this other site that's free. Or other people said that, it's going to be the end of your site, that, there'll be no more job. Like, people were worried there's going to be no more jobs. And if there's no more jobs, we're not going to come back to your site. All that stuff. Well, my stomach hurt for a couple of months, but I stuck with it. And, so in 1999, it just kind of chugged along. And by the end of 1999, I made a good amount of income. And I took a leave of absence. I had a break, and I didn't come back to teach. I told my boss that I wanted a semester off, kind of like a sabbatical. I told her, she knew about the business, and I said, she was great. I need a little bit of time. I'm going to have to pay taxes. I've never paid taxes before. I never had money. Government always gave me money.
That's the disadvantage of being from the U.S., isn't it? If you earn too much, you have to still pay no matter where you are.
Much. It was just none of it was tax. It wasn't so much that it was that I was earning too much. It was just like, if you have income, you got to pay tax on it. You got to pay state and federal tax. And so, or at least file, for that. But I knew what I was making, I was going to have to pay taxes. And I had no idea about accounting. And my dad introduced me to his accountant, and I was able to get started with that. And I really kind of needed some time off to think about the future of, where I was going, whether I was going to continue to teach. I was at the crossroads where, I had taught in California for 5 years at the university level, but at the same time, I had this opportunity of Dave's ESL Cafe, of moving this into the future, where I figured that I could always teach. I thought, even as a 70-year-old, and that's 10 years from now, but I feel really healthy. I don't know, but I should say as a 60-year-old, because I don't know if I'm going to be alive at 70, but as a 60-year-old, which at that time, God, I was in my 30s, seemed pretty old. But as a 60-year-old, I can teach now. I love people. I'd be a fine teacher. I mean, I could teach at 60, but I knew that I had the feeling I wouldn't have the opportunity or the creativity to do what I was doing at 60. And I was completely right, because now in retrospect, I know now that your priorities change. When you're 60, you start to think more about the end of your life or how many years you have, not so much left, but aren't even healthy years, things that you want to do. And making money or status or things or car or house are just not part of. They're maybe in your mind when you have children. And you have to educate them, and you have a family to support. And then later, when you start to get to the winter of your life, your priorities shift. I didn't. Now, mind you, I wasn't that deep then. I was just saying, 60 is old.
But it sounds like it was, at the beginning, when you started out in your 20s, money didn't really matter so much when you were backpacking and you took your year off. And then you had this, business life in the middle, and, towards the end, money, the same. It's also maybe a marker that you've been successful and that you've had enough money, because it sounds a little bit like Oprah, doesn't it? Oh, yeah, money doesn't matter so much to me, says multi-billionaire Oprah Winfrey.
Well, my dad used to say, when someone says it's not about the money, it's always about the money. But no, it's just, you're right. I have done really, really well on a small scale. Nothing like, I'm not incorporated. I'm a one-man business. It's me and my dogs, and I've always done everything myself. And so, but for me personally, financially I achieved more than I ever expected to, for me to achieve, because I'm not a very ambitious, believe it or not, I'm not a very ambitious, I'm actually more of a laid back person that tends to enjoy more the things outside of work, whether it's like even now, like motorcycling. I'm a prolific reader. I read one or two books a week, love music. I do now a lot of meditation and yoga, and I've gotten into like ice baths. And so I do ice baths.
Or like Wim Hof method, is it? Yeah.
I do. Yeah. I'm a Wim Hofer. Yeah. I had studied Wim Hof, and I do cold showers. And I do a cold shower in the morning and an ice cold shower in the afternoon. I do different breathing techniques. And once a week, I do an ice tub. Yeah. Yesterday, I usually get three soakings with an ice tub. So I put the ice in yesterday, and I was able to take an ice bath yesterday, last night, and I took one this morning. And then this afternoon is a little bit warmer. I was able to do three ice baths out of one go. But anyways, what I'm saying is I'm enjoying doing things away from work. I do like my work, and I do my work. Yeah. I mean, I, it's not to say that, but I think life has got, for me anyway, it has to be multidimensional. And I also find that I try to do things that frighten me a little bit, or things that I haven't done before that are new to me. Wim Hof would be a perfect example, because I hate cold.
Yeah, because see, you said earlier, you know, you love the climate in Thailand, and you
exactly.
And it never rains in Southern California. So
yeah, right. I've lived in a warm climate, and I suffered some of the winters in Tokyo, but you know,
well, I wouldn't say now the winters are in Tokyo are so much.
Yeah, you're from Ireland.
Yeah.
From it's, LA. For me, they were terrible, but I'm from LA. But for me, I'm talking about like showers had to be hot. Warm was not good enough. I mean, they had to be scorching hot showers. I mean, I was a real baby when it came to cold water. So it was, for me, it was almost like a dare, you know, that I wanted to, I knew the benefits of it. So I was afraid of skydiving, and I went skydiving a couple of years ago because it was something that I feared. I had a fear of heights, and it was something that I didn't think I'd be able to do. And motorcycling I love, even though I'm 60 and my brother is almost 70. We go on some crazy motorcycle adventures every week or two, and we do those together. So, you know, so I do have this, I do like to do my work. I enjoy it. And then I let go, and then I go ahead and I don't think about it. And I just kind of, you know, go on. And
so in all that time, you never employed anybody else. It's just been you.
I did have one friend from Thailand that I had known many, many years, named Colin. And so I met him in 88, and around when Dave's ESL Cafe just began to take off. So it'd been around 2000, 2001, maybe. I offered him, he wanted to come on over. And so he worked with me for a little while, maybe less than a year. And was kind of like a personal assistant a bit, you know, helping me with some of the work. And he was very organized. So he helped me set up a file system. I'm really disorganized. And he kind of helped me get things organized and he was like a personal assistant. Second eye on, you know, but after he left, I had not hired anybody. So essentially I ran the site, I say kind of 24/7. So I ran it in the craziest places in the world. You know, I used dial-up access. I ran it Luang Prabang, Laos, India, Thailand, Japan, Europe, Spain.
I mean, you were the original digital nomad.
In fact, the first time I heard that expression, I spend a lot of time up in San Francisco, and I was up there, and I went to this bakery and a cookie bakery, and she said, "Well, my husband and I are going to be leaving soon, and somebody else is going to take over." And I said, "Oh, really? What happened?" She goes, "We're going to be digital nomads." And I said, "What? I had no idea what she was talking about." She said, "Yeah." She told me what they were going to do. They were actually going to live in different places. They were going to start off in Thailand, and they were going to spend 3 months in Thailand and 3 months here. And they were just going to live around the world doing their online work. Well, I was doing that, not full time, but I would take trips and I would connect in some of the craziest places where, you know, like I remember being in Laos, and the hotel, there was, you know, like, the winds and the internet went out in the hotel, and I had to go to a cafe, and then the cafe closed and kicked me out, and it was nighttime, and it was like midnight in Luang Prabang, Laos, where I was like on the sidewalk, sitting cross-legged yoga position with my laptop, using the Wi-Fi, borrowing the
Wi-Fi. Piggybacking, we used to call it, didn't we?
Yeah. People walking past me, you know, I think some people were just about willing to put, you know, money in my cup, you know. I looked like a beggar with a laptop on my lap, sitting on the streets of Luang Prabang, Laos. But I worked in crazy places like India and all over the place, sometimes in Israel, northern Israel on the border of Lebanon. Once with my dad on a kibbutz. So I've run the business, and this is as a business, running it as a business. I've run it just all over the place. So my father, my late father, who lived to 93, was always really, really impressed with that. The idea that I had, I'm sure you can relate to this, but yeah. Having the freedom to be able to work anywhere in the world, not just for my house, but to be able to take off somewhere.
And you said your father is a businessman. He never once told you that you should settle down and become an accountant, as we said earlier, well, or get a proper job. Or did you have those?
Yeah, he did. But my dad was supportive when I, you know, he helped me with my master's program in linguistics. So he gave me some financial help to get through that. So he was, you know, he was just happy that I was getting an education and going back to school. But when I started, my dad called that, I don't know what he called that, internet stuff. You know, my dad wasn't wasn't happy. He thought I was wasting, my parents thought I was like really wasting my time. You know, they were not happy that I was spending so much time. I did not have their support. Now when I started making money, my dad... my dad was a big supporter, you know. Once it really took off, then my dad could understand. It's funny because my dad was quite old, not internet savvy, but my dad, he just got it. Younger, nobody else could quite get what I was doing. But my dad, as a businessman, and, you know, he had a nursery, a plant business. It was quite successful, you know, here in LA. And he had a good business instinct. And he just got it. He didn't quite understand all the technical things I was doing, but he understood it. He understood that there was a need for English teachers. My dad would tell me, you know, yeah, I get it. He goes, the world needs English. For my dad, English was a second language. He goes, yeah, it's a global language. You know, Korea needs teachers. You know, my dad just got it.
Well, business fundamentals are always the same, aren't they?
Yeah,
you know, no matter what the business.
Just knew he knew what I was doing very quickly. He got it. Where I would explain to even my siblings, I would try to explain it to my siblings, and it just went over their heads. They just couldn't really quite understand what I was doing or how I was making a living, or it just, you know, they didn't understand it. But my dad really was my cheerleader. He was really, when I had problems, and I had a lot of problems, and I don't know if you want me to go into them or not, but
please do, because we've all had them and still are. You know, they say you're either like going into a problem, in a problem, or coming out of a problem. So yeah.
Well, somebody told me if you can look at problems not as problems but as challenges, then you can have a different mindset.
That's what they used to tell us in customer service, wasn't it? To put these euphemisms, it's not customer service, customer care now, and it's not a problem, it's an issue. And
well, you can change your mindset, but there's some problems that, you know, you could call it a challenge, but the reality is it's a problem. It's a big problem. So I had, you know, problems with, and it's much easier to handle now, denial of service attacks, DDoS attacks. Site. Now you have ways to be able to circumvent that. You didn't back then.
Was this by independent agents or was it state sponsored?
I have no idea. I really don't. I have no idea. I don't know. You know, it happened a couple of times, but it was just terrible. It was just terrible because, you know, I mean, it was terrible. I had at that time a beeper. So I was just tell you, it predates the cell phone age. So when this was happening, the pager would go off every time my site would go down. And I remember being in a movie and running to a payphone and trying to get the server back up. And it was just a nightmare. And this happened once or twice. I'm not sure if it happened a second time. Once for sure, maybe a second time. Maybe the second time they were able to figure a quicker way to handle it. The worst thing that had ever happened to me was the old site, not the new site that I have now. It's been redesigned. And I had a lot of primitive software scripts that I had just, they were like shareware, what we call them, Perl scripts. It was like coding type of scripts so that I could make the site interactive. But they were not secure, and I didn't know that they weren't secure. They weren't safe. And I was at a cafe, and they had internet, and I was running my site. All was good. It was lunch hour. I came home, logged into my site again, ESLcafe.com. It was gone. Page not found. Try another thing, not found. I call my system administrator. You know, I paid money, you know, for the server. He gets lucky. I got a hold of him. He said, "You're getting hacked right now. We got to shut the." Yeah, he goes, "Right now." He goes, "I can see this guy." Was a guy, but they usually are. He goes, "I can see this person. I can see them. You know, I can see them. What they're doing." He goes, "They're hiding. They're hiding where they came from. Their traces by deleting each of the pages. So they would go into a section in order to hide where they came from. They would delete." My whole site was getting trashed. So he shut the server down, was able to, well, he said, "Okay, well, we're going to need a new server, but we have a problem." "What's that?" He goes, "Something messed up. We don't have a current backup of your site."
I feel your pain. Yeah.
What am I going to do? I go, okay. All right, let's do. So we went ahead, and a lot of it, you know, we could kind of put back together, you know, I mean, but the big thing was the jobs. So we had two job boards and, you know, maybe 500 or 600 jobs. I don't remember how many, 300 or 400 jobs at that time. I don't remember. So what I do, we had to shut the server down, get a new server, set everything up. And then what I had to do was hand post each of the jobs. I had to go through each of the orders that came in and then one by one, get them in chronological order, how they were, you know, put in the order that they were received. And one by one, I think I worked 24 hours straight or almost that much. I think I worked, you know, 18 or 19, you know, it happened in the afternoon. I went all night, most of the next day. I think I lost one night's sleep. I mean, I went the whole night all day, and it was really stressful. And then, you know, so we were down for a couple of days, and then, you know, we got back up again. And of course there were all these technical problems. This didn't work and fixed that, you know, I mean, and it was a nightmare. You know, we got the site back up. It wasn't perfect. It was good enough. We got most of it back, not necessarily the most up to date, but good enough. And that was, you know, so, you know, when you have things like this, you know, it could even be a shop that, you know, if you have a retail business that gets shoplifting or gets broken into, there's theft or a dog groomer. I take my dogs to a dog groomer. She works out of her house. The insurance company got upset because there were two claims against her. And so they called the city of LA, and the city of LA ordered her to close down. She couldn't operate. She had this business for years and years and years. She couldn't operate. So every business.
She had claims by customers, was it?
Anytime you have you know, there's always, you know, what,
did she clip the nails too short or something?
I'm not even sure 100% what happened, but but apparently the insurance company, they don't really like to insure dog groomers that are grooming out of the house.
Okay.
Because it's a home and all kinds of things can happen. And so it's, they want people to be either mobile or in their own shop. I'm not quite sure what the problem is, but she was just heartbroken. I mean, she had this wonderful business that made fantastic money, and she, you know, again, it's like me getting hacked. I mean,
the violation, isn't it? You feel like,
It is. I think any kind of business, you know, sometimes people are sued, or there's a threat of being sued, or angry customers or competitors that play unfair or, you know, play dirty, which I've had. And so, you know, you kind of have to, those are all the things that you kind of have to put up with. So since this is a business podcast, I think that's important for people to take in mind, that that you can't necessarily romanticize. I think being in your own business is the best. And I've been in my own business for, well, since I've been in my own business for, I don't know, 21, 22 years, something like that, running Dave's ESL Cafe. And I love it. I wouldn't change places. I wouldn't have done anything differently. But you can't romanticize. A lot of the things that happened, I had no idea that they were going to happen when I started. It all was really fun.
I think the phrase from meditation, isn't it? There's a honeymoon phase in when people start meditation, and then they say there's the kitchen sink phase, isn't there? It's like, oh yeah, I'm an entrepreneur, and then suddenly it's like, oh, I've got all these dirty dishes to clean.
Well, meditation, because I've done a lot of meditation, and it's a little bit, it's similar in the sense that it's kind of hard to get started. Same thing with the business. With meditation, you sit down and you know, like, I found it really, really hard to keep still in the beginning. And when I started meditation, everything itched. My butt itched. I itched here. My forehead itched. My head itched.
So you went more for the Zen, because, you know, the Zen idea is you don't move, but, you know, there's other types of meditation, like, people scratching
really
and moving.
You know, yeah. It's just like, you know, then it was like my thoughts were, oh, God, you know, my back hurts. Oh, this is not right. Oh, you know, I'm thinking too much. In the beginning, it really took me time to set, first of all, to learn to keep still. And the second thing was to learn to realize that I'm not supposed to control my thoughts. You know, I can't stop thought, you know, I mean, you know, and when I started to get it and not resist, then for me, the medication also helped. As a Freudian slip, make sure you take that medication before you meditate. And,
you know, Ritalin helps, I heard. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, a little downer right before the meditation. you kind of settle into it, and you kind of realize that when you kind of let the thoughts come and just kind of get yourself back centered again, you find that over time you get better and better at just kind of letting it go and just kind of getting more into that wonderful still state of mind. And so, but the business is similar in that sense, where I think the beginning is rough too. There's just a lot of, you know, they talk about a startup. It's exciting. You know, I'm starting something new, but it's hell. You know, there's a lot of difficulties with a startup, whether it's getting funding or staff, or a lot of stress that first year of being able to make it work. And then you have all kinds of problems too. There's problems that come up, and then hopefully you can get to a stage where things just kind of run smoothly. That's kind of like where I've reached with Dave's ESL Cafe. I've redesigned the site so that, you know, it's really manageable. It's not stressful. I don't really have the problems that I had before. I can do everything smoothly and easily in less time.
So as much as people, you know, love Dave's ESL Cafe, we've grown up with it. Another part of Dave's ESL Cafe, which we touched on a little bit, was the forum. That's a beast of its own, isn't it?
Tell me about the forum on
Dave's ESL.
Well, the forums right now are kind of out of commission. Maybe someday you can still access them, but they just grew too big. They outgrew the software that I was using, and they outgrew my capabilities to manage them. So the first problem was the software, and it was just like I waited too long. I kept updating the software until I couldn't, and then they kept growing and growing and growing, and then it got to the point where to change software was going to be really difficult. So how do we change? So how do we get all of the content onto? Okay. So then it was a lot of like trying to think, how are we going to get this to work? In the meantime, the current software was breaking down. So we had to put it, you know, like we had to stop the ability for people to post because it just, there were too many problems with people logging in. It wasn't working. But going back, the forums have always been a difficult thing.
Security-wise, you know, I was advised not to have a forum because it's a kind of a soft underbelly of a site. Is that your...
It is. I mean, I don't know if I regret it now. I mean, it probably was a really important component of my site starting up. You know, we had all kinds of problems. I mean, you know, in the beginning I had volunteer moderators, and sometimes the moderators would fight among themselves. Suddenly it was like a staff, you know, like... You know, one moderator didn't like another moderator.
And this was before our current political age, our divisive.
This was the
original Twitter, really.
This moderator is too strict. You know, this moderator is, you know, he deleted a post he shouldn't have deleted. This, you know, and then you'd get just like the internet, you know, like, you know, you'd get a bit of bullying, you know, that would go on because people could be anonymous. You'd get, people that would post some good reviews. I mean, some accurate reviews, I should say, about schools. But then I would get other people that would post really negative reviews about schools. And then I would hear from a teacher or a school owner that would say, well, this is what happened, really. You know, they would explain. It could even be another teacher that was explaining why that other teacher was posting this. He goes, well, you know, and I would hear the situation from a whole nother perspective. And I realized that it was damaging the school. It was, you know, I didn't like that. You know what I mean? It's not to say that I don't want teachers to be warned. I think that's really important. But it was very difficult for me to verify the accuracy, because the truth is, what is really accurate? You know, what is the truth? You know what I mean? I mean, what is the truth? I certainly can't research it. I'm going to hear one side from the owner, one side from the person, another side from another teacher that says, well, this is what happened. I can't be a judge on determining. So basically, the only thing I could do was really delete the posting. If a school owner complained, I had to delete it because I really did not know what was true and what was not true. I got a lot of backlash for that. I got a lot of, you know, there was a lot of even putting me on a blacklist, claiming that I was, you know, not supporting the teachers, or, you know, letting bad schools take advantage. You know, they thought there were paying customers I was deleting paying customer.
You're damned if you do, damned if you don't. Yeah,
you are. So I was that. And then it started to get even more pressure. I mean, I started to get one time I got a subpoena from an attorney in LA. So there was like a school, big school in China that was threatening to sue me, and got this big law firm in LA and subpoenaed me. And I didn't go into all this for that, you know. I mean, it was just like, I called a lawyer. They wanted me to go in for a deposition. And I said, look, you know, I mean, that means I got to get a lawyer. I got to go in. I go, what's this about? I called her up and she goes, look, there's this posting here. You know, would you delete this posting and, you know, ban this person? You know, yeah, I will do that.
Sure.
I don't have the stomach for lawyers and depositions, and I'm a free spirit. I maybe the person wrote complete truth, But
you couldn't afford Johnny Cochran, so
I know it was just like this, I wasn't into this. I wasn't into a legal fight over, you know, this. So I just said, yeah, I mean, this I couldn't have won anyway. This was a big school, and this was a major law firm in Los Angeles. I mean, a Beverly Hills law firm. And so I did what they asked me to do. I didn't have to do it at deposition. I just cooperated with them on the phone, did what they needed, asked me to do, did that. And so that goes back to the forums, and it just was really growing too big for me. And so I put it on pause because it really was just a mess. It was like a garden that had become overgrown with weeds, really. I just was completely unmanageable. I mean, it was like a house that needed to be knocked down, you know. It was just, I don't know what to do. So I put it on pause, and then I kept toying with talking with my system administrator. We kept coming up with ideas on what to do. Should we archive this and start a new forum? Should we do this? And then COVID hit. I had renovated my new site, so I was really busy moving that over. And by the time I got used to running that site, it just wasn't a priority. I have it archived, and who knows, maybe someday if I can figure out. There still is hundreds of thousands of postings that people can access and read, and there's still some good information. But
I think I posted something back in the day, maybe 10 years ago, and actually very helpful, helped me a lot. Yeah, a lot of great responses. Yeah,
there is. But it's also a different age now. I mean, you know, you have Facebook, you have Reddit. I mean, I use Reddit all the time. I'm a big fan of Reddit. Are you familiar with Reddit?
Yeah, sure. I don't use it so much, but I'm kind of getting a little bit more into it now.
It's wonderful. Yeah. I mean, when I have to search for something, anything and everything. You can certainly, I'm sure, find plenty of ESL information on Reddit. But like, for example, I have these, you can see my lights. Ooh, let there be light. These are huge. Nice. I'm in my daughter's art studio. My daughter's an artist, so I will show you some of her.
Wow, incredible. Yeah.
I'm in her studio. But anyways, I was installing these Hue programmable lights that you can control like online with an app and all that stuff. And I was running into problems, and I just searched like Hue lights connecting Reddit, and boom, all this stuff came out, and there were fantastic solutions. I was able to, just like YouTube, I installed a, my brother's a fan of a bidet. You know what a bidet is? Well, hell, they come out.
It reminds me of Crocodile Dundee. Yeah, that scene.
Yeah. Well, I never was a fan of bidets, you know. And in Japan, I would avoid them, you know. And but my brother, who's a real macho construction dude, you know, he got this a bidet attachment for like $40, and he was a
bidet
big,
was very 80s thing in Europe.
Oh,
I think. Yeah.
My brother was going on and on and on how this thing was better than sliced bread, you know. Well, after about a year of this, I thought, you know, maybe I should give this a try. I'm going through toilet paper a little too quickly. Maybe I should give it a try. So I ordered one on Amazon, and how to install it, I went on YouTube, you know, there you go, you know. And so the thing is that things have changed with YouTube broadcasts, even about ESL or teaching broadcasts, or like the kind of podcasts that you have, Reddit forums. I just kind of find that the type of forums that I had in the past, to me anyways, and I might be wrong, and I know that there are supporters out there that still love them, to me they seem a little outdated compared to how things are, especially too when you can do even type of Zoom, even type of video chats to rooms and be able to get information. It's a very different era, and I just find that that structure of forums are – just a little bit out of date.
I think a few people have migrated to Facebook. There's some great groups, yeah, isn't there, with Dave's ESL forum regulars or something. So
there are. I'm a member of some nothing with ESL. I'm a member of dog haircut. Yeah, it's a breed that I have. One of my dogs breed, you know, I have a schnoodle and a breed called a Miki. So, you know, there's user groups on Facebook that I'm, I have these geeky, you know, rock group memberships, Facebook memberships. So I'm, you know, members of that. And you have different ways to be able to get that information, to share that information now. And so I still have a lot of really good information. I still have a lot of really good material that's relevant for students and teachers, printout material that's there that's been created that will never really go out of date. But my site, I guess, is predominantly a job site. You know, it's a job board, and, you know, that's where my main focus has
been. And so the new site, so migrating over, I mean, you're using WordPress, is that right, for your new site, or is it proprietary?
It is proprietary. It's a Windows based. I forgot what it's called. Just tells you how. It's a type of program that's used on a Windows server, and it's just slipped my mind. It'll come to me. But anyways, I hired a company. This would have been, oh goodness, what was it, 2 years ago? Let's see. It would have been close to 3 years ago. I hired a company in LA. I decided to hire a company, a local company based in LA, and to spend the money and to actually redo the site right, because it really was showing its wear and tear. It was really, like, people would say that some liked it because they thought it was like from the 90s. They go, yeah.
Natsukashi, is that what the, you know, as Japanese would say, you know, has a nostalgia to it. Right.
But it wasn't just that the look of it was out of date, but I couldn't navigate the site myself. I mean, I couldn't even get to that main page and get to where I wanted to go. But on the back end, on my end, to run the site was very difficult. So I had to process the credit cards. So the orders would come in, and then I would have to process each one myself, each of the credit card orders that came in. And then the text itself was sent to me in a message. So the text of the ad, the title, the location. So I had to copy and paste each and every ad into another, you know, submission form, you know, my own like admin form, in order to get that job posting on. So each posting, by the time I processed the credit cards, copied and pasted the text into the ad, maybe each posting, one job posting, maybe took me 10 or 15 minutes. So if I had in one day, you know, 20 or 30 ads, I was spending a long, long time just processing the financial part of it and then getting the ads actually onto the site. So that was
so labor intensive. Yeah,
it was really labor intensive. And I did this for years and years and years. I know it needed to shift over, but I was like one of these guys that, well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, and it was like, I knew it was just going to be a major hassle to switch it over, and it was working. And so I went on like this. There were other also labor intensive things. I had a primitive resume, a database board, and I had to go through each resume. And it was, again, the site was taking me a lot of hours every day, not complaining, because it's just what I did. I didn't complain about it. I enjoyed it, but I knew that it was not the way to do things. I knew it was just, so I hired a company to redo everything completely. I told them what I needed and what my problems were. And it took about a year. It took a long time. Probably by the time we got everything right, it was close to a year, maybe 8, 9 months, 10 months. It was a lot of work, a lot of testing, a lot of, the price kept going up because I kept having to add things that I had forgotten to tell them to do, or something needed to be done. And then I got to an accident. My motorcycle came down, but I wasn't hurt. It just fell down. But when I went to lift it up, the motorcycle weighs about 700 pounds we use pounds here in America.
Well, they are in the UK now because they're reverting back to the imperial measures after Brexit.
Yeah. Whatever that is, you know, whatever that is in kilos, 1,000+ kilos.
2.2 is it divided by something, yeah.
I went to lift the bike up and I got it 3/4 up and then I was on my tippy toes and my Achilles tendon snapped. It just snapped, the band. And then, the bike fell and then I fell. And then
I've had a slight tear on Achilles tendon before, and it is so painful.
Yeah, well,
burning kind of pain.
Yeah, I had a. This was a full snap.
Yeah, I can't imagine. Yeah,
this was a can't walk snap. So this came down. So I could kind of barely walk. It was all, you know, rubbery. And then I went to. I ended up, you know, finding out what it was and had to go into orthopedic and I had to get surgery ASAP. And so I had surgery. I was in a cast and I was literally out of commission for 6 months before I was able to be back on my feet again and be somewhat normal. And so that took – anyways, so now that I've created everyone's sympathy, see what happens – after that, I wasn't in the state of mind. There were a couple of other things to get the site up and running. But last year, in February, I finally had the energy and the mood to do it. And then we did everything we needed to do. And then in March of last year, we switched over and we put the new site live. We switched it over completely, 100%. That was on a Friday or Saturday. On the Monday was the beginning of all the lockdowns, the COVID lockdowns. The timing couldn't have been, it was either the best timing or the worst timing to do this. COVID hit. And so the whole business, my whole business, like a lot of businesses, my whole business just died because of COVID. People couldn't travel. But the good news is my site is really super easy to navigate. It's really super easy for me to run. What took me a couple of hours, I can do in minutes now, you know? So, yeah.
And what's for the future? Just let it run? Or
9:30, bed.
Bed.
Bedtime. What's the future? Yeah, you know, the future right now is to see exactly where the ESL market is going to go. Aside from Dave's ESL Cafe, the world has just really been hit by not just a medical catastrophe, but an economic catastrophe. And so travel is just virtually stopped. I mean, you know, for most places in the world, you just really can't go to or not easily. ESL, in a sense, or teaching EFL or ESL, it's a travel business. You know, I mean, if you are from Ireland or from the US or Australia and you want to teach in a particular place, you have to travel there to get on a plane and travel. And with all the lockdowns and the travel restrictions and vaccinations and Delta now, you know, hitting and the different strains, it's made it very difficult for, you know, the EFL, the teaching industry, the travel industry, and especially the tourist industries for countries that are incredibly dependent. Like you mentioned Kyoto, but then you have countries like Thailand, which is just the dependency on tourism is just tremendous. And people are just, now they're going into the second year of just absolutely just no work and not a lot of support from the government. Probably going to get in trouble for saying this because Thailand is so sensitive, but it's the truth. It's the truth that there are people that are just, you know, I mean, that it just trickles down to jobs that you wouldn't even consider that you didn't even think were part of the tourist industry. Like I have a brother-in-law that he's a mechanic and he is a mechanic for the buses, the tour buses. So when the tour buses come in, he indirectly works for the tour industry because he got a company for the big buses, the big tourists. There's no tourists, you know, in Chiang Mai, especially the Chinese, they can't enter. So he's been out of work for now going into a second year. So if you ask me what the future is, really it's going to be dependent upon what's happening with COVID, how it's going to affect my business, my future might mean that I personally need to scale down my, you know, what's happening in my life, my financial, you know, I might have to move into a smaller house or make some lifestyle changes in order to afford things. So right now it's not so much thinking about like other ways to make money, but it's more just trying to scale my lifestyle to see what happens with COVID in my business, and to see too whether my business will come back. Just like any business, some businesses get affected and they never come back. I may bounce back in 2-3 years, and I may not. I'm okay with either scenario. I mean, I've had a really wonderful run since 1999. I've had a fantastic run with this. The site's not going away. I'll always be there. But it's kind of right now just to kind of see what's going to happen with the teaching industry around the world. It's kind of up and down, up and down. It just keeps changing, you know, week by week, day by day, new outbreaks that come about, new regulations, ads that now just say, you know, we're hiring only teachers. You must be in Japan in order to get the job, or you must be in Korea in order to get the job. It's a huge change. And then the move now over to online teaching.
And China, of course, as well, which is...
China, yeah. China was my biggest, before COVID, they were my biggest client base, and it's really disappeared. I mean, you know, I just don't think, I don't know what's going on, really. I know that they've had some current outbreaks, but I'm not quite sure what's going on with the teaching scene over there. But
I think they banned Bitcoin this week.
Have they?
Yeah. So yeah, a lot's happening, yeah.
Yeah, so there's a lot happening. So it's kind of and again, like I said, there's a big shift with online teaching. And I used to think in the beginning of COVID that it was going to be something that would be just temporary. But I don't think I'm not saying that we're not going to have live, you know, person to person classroom based teaching. That I don't think that'll ever disappear. But there will be a major shift into online teaching, because I've been, I don't want to say victim, because I've benefited. I've benefited myself from not teaching, but I've been able to take classes and do retreats and learn, especially like meditation, and learn courses that I would never have been able to do if it wasn't. It's like a silver lining of COVID, you know, I mean, it's like I was able to get opportunities to be able to learn things, for example, that are offered in India, that it would have been impossible for me really to be able to fly off to India and go into a retreat and be able to do the things that I've done. And now I can do it online. I'm in an isolated studio here in the backyard of my house, and I can actually, you know, be in an ashram in India by Zoom and actually get taught by, you know, world-class meditation teachers and learn things. So I am now convinced that, yeah, there's definitely going to be a big shift, not 100%, but it's kind of like with the things I'm doing, with the Zoom things that I'm doing, some of the retreats and stuff, after COVID goes away, they will continue on, because what they realize is that they now have a global market. They can get more people into online retreats than they can in an actual, you know, face-to-face retreat. It's a lot easier. So there'll be a shift to that, and being a shift to that will affect you know, my business as well. There'll probably be less ads for, you know, teachers and more ads for online teachers, but. Yeah, you just go with the flow, go with the change, you know, the earth turns.
And it sounds like the Zen story of the Zen master who was handed the child. You know that story? He was accused of fathering a child, and they in the Japanese village, and the parents took and says, you have to look after this child. And the Zen master said, what did he say? Okay, no problem. And then, of course, he took care of the child very lovingly for 2 years. And then they realized that the mother was lying, that, you know, the abbot hadn't fathered the child. So they went up and said, oh, so sorry. And they took the child back and he said, oh, okay, no problem. So whether he was accused, he had the child, or, you know, this child he'd obviously formed a bond with, was taken from him, didn't bother him either way. So I think you're kind of in that mindset. So,
Yeah. Yeah, it's really an important thing that to just let go, to know that. I mean, if I've learned anything, it's just the everything is temporary. I mean, it's just, you know, and even the moment. I mean, you know, I have this moment and I'm talking with you, and it's wonderful. I'm enjoying this moment and we've been having a great conversation, but it will end and it'll just be almost like a dream. I'll go into my bedroom and read my book and crash out, and it'll be just kind of like, you know, almost dreamlike, you know. I mean, it's just all I have is just all that. The only thing that is really kind of clear in my foggy head is just like what I have right in front of me. Like, you know, and so I know that, you know, it's kind of a cliche, you know, you got to live in the present moment. It said so much that you kind of like, and I think it's a lot easier to grasp if you look at just everything that happens before is just really dream. It's like a dreamlike, because it's such a faded memory, you know. You cannot remember. It's just faded. It's just, you know, I mean, as soon as I walk away into the house, I can't remember everything I told you. It's just a fade. I mean, if someone even said, what do you look like? I'll say, well, I think he had a beard. I'm not sure now. Well, was he wearing glasses? I think so. Even that is like right now I can look at you. I can say, oh, he's got glasses. He's got this color beard. And so, you know, it just, if you look at it like that, it's a lot easier to focus on kind of what's in front of you if you kind of have that perspective. But if you just keep saying live in the present moment, it's kind of too preachy, because it's hard. You know, a lot of times we're not living in the present moment, and it's fine. It's okay. You just once in a while have to remind yourself, you know, it's you can't, I think, be too hard on yourself and say, you know, yeah.
So on that note, Dave, I think we'll recognize impermanence and we'll call it a day. And Dave, it's been such a pleasure. I normally don't have, you know, podcasts this long, but I just felt we had to go the full Joe Rogan with this today and take a kind of a long form. And it was really fascinating hearing about your life and you know, I'm sure we could have spoken a lot more, and I really do hope I'm sure the listeners will get a lot of value from this podcast. And Dave, what's the best way to contact you if people want to post an ad or get in touch with any business ideas?
The best way would just go to the website, which is just www.eslcafe.com. Just type in eslcafe.com, and then from there you can either do, there's a contact Dave form, and of course there's recruit teachers, how to post an ad and all that stuff. And the main page, finally, it's really easy to navigate to get really to either contact me or get to the entire website. So, yeah.
Okay. So Dave Sperling, thank you again.
Thank you very much. It was nice to meet you, Philip. Enjoyed talking, and have a great day in Tokyo.
Thanks for listening to the EFL Magazine Business Podcast with Philip Pound. For more great advice and resources, check out eflmagazine.com. If you found this podcast helpful, be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. See you next time.